Hi everyone, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel, coming to you today from Sapporo in Japan. Today we'll be talking to Zhen Zhang and Martin Zaksa, who are respectively a research fellow in anthropology and sociology at the University of Queensland in Australia, and research group leader of the project Remoteness and Connectivity, Highland Asia in the World, at Ludwig Maximilians Universität in Munich, Germany, about their edited volume, The Art of Neighbouring, Making Relations Across China's Borders, which was published last year, 2017, by Amsterdam University Press. And I should add that it's also available on open access, so get on there and look for it. Now, China, it will come as a surprise to no one to hear, is a growing presence in all of our worlds today. But among all the billions of people worldwide who felt the effects of this country's rise over the past two or three decades, those living directly on China's borders have arguably had the most direct experiences of the changes which this process has brought about. Conversely, Chinese people who live close to neighbouring countries, or indeed cross borders into them, may be seen as vanguards of China-driven transformations unfolding on a vast scale in economics, politics, culture, kinship, and other spheres in Asia and beyond. And of course, they're also recipients of a lot of those transformations. In light of this, Zhen Zhang and Martin Zaksa's edited volume, The Art of Neighbouring, is a timely contribution to our understanding of what is going on at many of the points of China's local contact with its 14 neighbouring states. With contributions from anthropologists, geographers, and historians drawing on extensive fieldwork all around China's borders with Russia, Laos, Nepal, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Mongolia, Myanmar, and Vietnam, this is as comprehensive a volume as we yet have on the extraordinarily diverse Asian neighbourhood which China inhabits and its relationship with it. Yet beyond being a mere survey of differently located answers to questions about what China's rise means for its immediate neighbours, The Art of Neighbouring is also a theoretical intervention into debates over how states and peoples who live cheek by jowl engage one another. Discussions of how Chinese actors and the Chinese state approach the outside world are, of course, centuries old, but this fresh and lively collection on this question specifically offers readers a wealth of ways to approach not only this issue, but the broader question and more sort of capacious concept of neighbouring in general. But to talk more about the book and what its diverse contents tell us about the art of neighbouring, I'd like to welcome its two editors, Zhen Zhang and Martin Zaksa. Welcome to the podcast.
Welcome, Ed.
Hello, Ed. Thank you very much for having us here. It's such a pleasure.
It's great to have you, and thank you very much for editing such a fascinating collection. Now, perhaps I could begin by asking each of you what your backgrounds are, how you came to the fields that you are now in, and how you came to focus on China's borders. I suppose, Jen, perhaps you could say something about that first.
Yeah, thank you very much. So I came to this topic actually quite by accident, because I've never really lived close to the border regions between China and any other sort of countries in Southeast Asia. But for some reason, I had this fascination about a particular period in China's past, that's the Sino-Vietnamese border war that started from 1979 all the way to the end of 1980s. So that started a fascination with the border areas and its transformations, especially in the post-reform era. So I guess that initiated my research interest into understanding social change in China's border regions, especially between China and Vietnam. And therefore, when I pursued my PhD in anthropology, I thought I should, you know, go down there to the borderland and have a look and see how things are. So that's sort of my journey into the border area, and started thinking about various kinds of issues, including border trade, including sort of the contemporary social relations between Chinese and Vietnamese, trafficking, and smuggling, and all these very colorful stories that you hear typical of, you know, borderlands. Anyway, yeah.
So that's and had you kind of studied things to do with anthropology and borders at all as an undergraduate, or where did this interest in the Vietnam-China war specifically come from?
Not really. Actually, my background was my undergraduate study was in urban planning, so it's really quite far from either sociology or anthropology. At that time, like any other, I guess, Chinese student, I basically followed what my father wanted and studied urban planning because he thought this would lead to a very good sort of stable career down the track. But then I decided to do my master's in Singapore at National University of Singapore in sociology. In particular, in urban sociology. And that's where I sort of took on a project about ethnic boundary making in a multicultural society like Singapore, when I studied migrant workers, how they mark out different public spaces in Singapore and how they maintained the kind of boundary. So not borders per se, but I started to develop an interest in boundary maintenance and boundary making from a more theoretical level. So when I wanted to do a PhD, incidentally, my advisor for my master's was an anthropologist. So he successfully sort of lured me over into anthropology. Then I decided to do a PhD in anthropology with Pan Niri at that time at Macquarie University in Sydney, Australia. Well, I really wanted to focus the study on China, but not on China, but not on China in the sense that not sort of on the minorities, not on sort of urban issues, not on the hot topics at that time. And border issues remained sort of a relatively understudied area. And I really wanted to do something that I guess not a lot of people have studied at that time. But there's also a personal interest on border issues because my dad was a veteran soldier. He did not participate in the border war between China and Vietnam, but in other sort of conflicts back in the 1960s. So he basically followed the event when I was growing up. I listened about what's happening and thought about, you know, what would happen if, you know, my dad was enlisted and I had to go to the battlefield and things like that. So I guess it has always remained sort of a topic of interest in my mind. Yeah.
Wow, yeah, absolutely. That's fascinating. And yeah, very understandable then that you would want to bring this to the fore, really, in this volume. Martin, how about you? Perhaps you could say something about your own academic background, how you became interested in the subject that you've continued to work on to this day. And perhaps also you could fill us in on how the project for this book, The Art of Neighboring, came about.
Yes, I was doing a PhD in Tibet on a completely different topic, actually. I was working on the industry of Tibetan medicine, or the creation of an industry in Tibetan for Tibetan pharmaceuticals. And while I was doing this, I started looking into plant trade, because Tibetan medicine as an herbal-based medicine is a thing that is heavily dependent on things that actually don't grow on the Tibetan plateau. About 80% in volume of the raw materials used in Tibetan medicine, they are actually imported from other places, mainly from South Asia. So I was looking into these cross-border trade networks for medicinal plants, and I realized that actually, quite contrary to the assumption me and many other people had at that time, namely that trans-Himalayan trade was a thing of the past, I realized that actually there was a lot going on, not just along the main arteries of trade or the official road that connects Kathmandu and Lhasa, the friendship highway, but actually along all these other little border crossings that I thought had actually fell in decline over the past 30, 40 years. So looking into this, I started becoming more and more interested in this question of borders and cross-border trade. And I realized that there was, these were the times, this was maybe 2010, 2011, and I realized that China was everywhere in the news, but everybody was always talking about like China and the world and these big geopolitical rifts that were ongoing, but nobody was really looking into what this rise of China, whatever it means, actually means for the people living directly along the borders. So I started working on a postdoc project entitled Neighboring China. And with this, I went to the Asia Research Institute in Singapore as a postdoc in Prasenjit Dwara's Inter-Asia cluster. And there in Singapore, in this the Asia Research Institute, ARI, was at that time still in the botanical gardens, in this tower block, this ugly tower in the middle of the botanical gardens, which was actually a laboratory building. And I was given an office space in the 8th or 9th floor, in a windowless office, and there I met Juan. So we became office colleagues. And there in this box in the 9th floor of the tower building in Singapore, actually right away we saw that we had many, many shared interests, and we decided to do a workshop together on this topic, on neighboring China. Mm-hmm. Which we then did in 2012, and that was the seed that later became this volume.
I see. So the participants at the initial workshop were also the contributors to the volume, is that correct?
More or less, yes, with some changes.
I see. And I guess I'm always curious, before we move on to the kind of content of the book, practically speaking, we're co-editing something. How did the two of you divide the labor between the various parts of the book that need putting together, the writing of the introduction, the actual editing of the contributions? Jen, what shape did that process take as you were actually coming to put the book into, sort of put it together?
Oh, wow. Actually, I don't quite remember now how it got together, because right after, so this is sort of the format of a lot of the ARI, the Asia Research Institute, workshop formulas that by the time when we had the workshop, all the participants should already have a written paper. So based on that, we literally already had a full set of first drafts so that we can then put them in different sections and see how certain thematic threads could emerge. And that's how we think that perhaps an edited volume would work. So then, since we shared the same windowless office on the 9th floor at ARI's tower block, so there's nothing much to do, but we had lots of time discussing, you know, how we can proceed with the book project. And yeah, so as far as I can remember, it was quite natural that we basically talk about teacher papers, thought about the overall structures, and then come up with drafts, and then we just basically exchanged by email or when we talked about the project altogether. So yeah, I think it took a long time, but overall I think it was quite a smooth collaborative process. Martin, am I correct? Yeah.
Oh, it was wonderful working with you, Joanne. It was really one of the very nice, very good experiences of doing this with somebody. We somehow found a similar language right from the start. It became more difficult then in the end when we had both left Singapore. So then it was less of this informal day-to-day conversation. Then it was really about tying it down and bringing it to an end, which was more complicated. But overall, I still remember this as a wonderful and very, very creative process, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think it's certainly the case that's not always a positive relationship that people find when working together on things in academia. So I'm very pleased to hear that it was so smooth, and I think that comes out very clearly in the book, the way that the narrative flows and the structure of it. You're absolutely right, Martin, that there's a consistency to the language and to the approach, which makes it really hang together very well, despite the real richness and diversity of the contributions. So perhaps we could actually jump right into the content of the book at this point. You begin by sort of setting the scene and really doing a lot of the kind of theoretical introduction the introduction, surprisingly enough, which is entitled Neighbouring in the Border Worlds Along China's Frontiers. And as both of you have sort of alluded to in your initial remarks there, this collection and this group of scholars that you've brought together here do something quite new in bringing China's diverse borderlands into dialogue. But it is also the case that really when you're coming from the Siberian borderlands of northeast or northern China, down to the Himalayas or Southeast Asia, that you're still dealing with a really vast range of different situations. So perhaps I could ask one or other of you, Jen, why don't you say something about what kind of different situations are we dealing with here? I mentioned some of the countries there in the introduction, but could you just say something about all of the, or not all, but a selection of the different locations that feature in the different chapters of the book?
Yeah, thanks. That's a very good question. Actually, I think at the beginning when we started to conceptualize this project, we had a bit of, trouble in terms of finding that common analytical, framework that could tie these different places and this different, I hesitate to say case studies, but more like different kinds of ethnographic examples. How can we analytically bring them together and for them to still seem like a very coherent set of, studies about the topic on what China means to many of these neighboring countries and people live directly along the national borders. So I think eventually we think neighboring can be that analytical concept that many of these chapters can engage. Of course, our initial sort of departure point is also to challenge the notion that because China, so when we were starting with this project, there's always sort of very, there's a lot of geographical kind of restraints on, how we think about China's relations with its borders. When we talk about China and Southeast Asia, it's always China as the domineering kind of figure, whereas Southeast Asia is the smaller neighbors, smaller brothers. Whereas when we talk about China and Russia, it's completely a different politics when we're thinking about these kind of relationships. So we were trying to look for that common language to bring these different things together to think about similarities rather than differences. At the same time, we were trying to challenge that notion that it's either conflict or sort of friendship, harmony, this sort of very bifurcated construction about how China manages very diverse relations with its neighbors. So we were trying very much to capture that intimate relation, yet there are lots of conflict going on. So it's a very dynamic process at the same time, full of contradictories. So this is, the core theme that help us to conceptualize how we can bring these very different cases together and different diverse locations together in this collected volume. Yeah, so that's what I can remember right now, sort of the thinking behind this project. Yeah.
Sure, sure. No, that makes a lot of sense. And it has certain sorts of theoretical implications, this idea of neighboring, I suppose, for the figure of the neighbor, who the neighbor is, who is the neighbor in our kind of anthropological or political or sociological imagination. Martin, what kind of, within this idea of neighbouring, who is the neighbour? That's not too bizarre and abstract a question.
Well, the neighbour is the one who is neighbouring. that is probably what we realised very early on, that we wouldn't take neighbouring as some sort of pre-given geographical condition, but rather as verb, as active process, and maybe as a category of human relations also, a category that hasn't received the attention it deserves, we believe. I mean, isn't it interesting? You have a lot of literature on things like kinship or ethnicity or nationhood, which are very clearly like the strong forces of human relations that shape a lot of what we do and dream about and how we see the world. But neighboring is sort of a thing that always only comes to the forefront once there is trouble, yeah? Once good neighbors start fighting with each other. But neighboring is an interesting thing because it's not been looked at as a category of human relations in sociology or in anthropology. And our idea was to do a very initial, very first step towards a larger conceptualization of neighboring, or maybe rather to make this work for the purpose of our volume, because the process of neighboring as a verb, as an activity, is something that really unites all the papers in this volume.
And what about, I mean, to return to that sort of fundamental idea, that statement of the neighbor is the one who is neighboring. I mean, when it comes to questions of distance, for example, is that the key operating category here? Is proximity the main constraint or the main defining characteristic, or is there a lot of other things going on?
Can I answer this, Juan?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, please, okay. Martin.
Yes, of course, proximity in one or the other kind is probably always a precondition for any form of neighboring. Yeah, but it's not the kind of proximity that can be measured in kilometers or miles or in hours walked. We very soon realized that actually there are very different kinds of processes of neighboring going on in all these areas this book is concerned with. I mean, there is one situation which you find in many places along China's borders where you have one particular group or ethnic group that lives on both sides of the Chinese border. Yeah. So you have you basically have neighboring within a particular group, but across national borders. But then you also have other contexts where you have different groups living in the borderlands, basically a neighboring between different groups, but within the boundaries of national territory. Or you have like in Juan's case, you have different groups and a relation that crosses international borders. So yes, proximity is important, but we didn't want to sort of use neighboring as the overarching big conceptual lens through which everything can be explained. It's more like one of these mid-level concepts that help you put things in relation.
I think that makes a lot of sense as a kind of as an optic through which to examine this diversity of different situations. And then I guess finally, sort of from this introductory part, of course, the other thing that unites countries and the neighboring situations that we're dealing with is, again, this is blatantly obvious, but China is there at the center of it all. You touch in the introduction on some older ideas, classical ideas about China's relationship with the world that surrounds it. Of course, there's the sort of tired old idea of or at least the often misinterpreted old idea of what being this middle kingdom, this Zhongguo, means. A lot of ideas as well discussed about how China interacts and has historically interacted with surrounding powers through ideas of Huai Rou, this idea of things like cherishing people, for cherishing strangers from afar and so on. Jen, could you say something about how your idea of neighboring and how the book brings together ideas about China's relationship with the outside world from a sort of China-focused perspective?
Yeah, so, when we started to thinking about, actually, this is also a point of debate when we conceptualize this project, because immediately, of course, China is always the buzzword and the center of, you know, attention at that time. And we were thinking, can we put China in such a place that, it is a obvious presence, but then its relation is not sort of determined by, you know, being the buzzword, being sort of the attraction point where people just want to understand what is China doing, what China has, what China means to other people. We want to sort of turn this analytical lens around to understand underground how people understand it beyond these official rhetorics, beyond news headlines, and beyond these sensational reports about, you know, China's economic takeoff and all of these other processes that are going on. So in that sense, I think we're trying very hard to separate ourselves from the classical sort of Sino-centered studies on China's relations with other countries. This is sort of very typical in the classic studies of, what's the word, tributary systems, China's engagement with Southeast Asia and other Asian countries, in the sense that China being the cultural center and being the sort of economic and political centers in this region. So what we also want to do is perhaps take a perspective from James Scott's work on the art of not being governed to sort of bring that ethnographic understanding of the everyday details that are actually happening about the strategies that people use in terms of how they actually define China's presence, how they try to both take advantage of China's rise, at the same time, they try to maintain certain distance. So in that very dynamic balancing act, we see neighboring takes place, because neighboring precisely is about maintaining certain closeness to make the best use of resources, make the best use of whatever opportunities that's out there, but at the same time to maintain that critical distance so that, the self and the other can always be differentiated in certain ways. Yeah.
Mm. And that makes a huge amount of sense when one considers that this work, this book is based on lots of cases of really deep ethnographic involvement in these various borderland situations. I suppose it's the case that a lot of these classic ideas of Sino-centric views, as you say, about tributary relations and so on, are written from a certain level of elevation or indeed historical distance that makes that kind of conclusion seem a strong one to arrive at. Whereas when you've got a rich array of very local, very nuanced situations in all kinds of different locations around the border, I guess some of these larger broad brushstroke type conceits are a bit more difficult to arrive at, and we're much better treating the situation, as you mentioned earlier, Martin, through this sort of, as you say, mid-level concept of neighbouring or something like this. So that's brilliant. We could perhaps then jump into the first section of the book, which consists of three chapters. The title of the section is Border Worlds, and we're dealing here with situations on the Sino-Russian border. That's Fong Biye, who authored that chapter, one on the Sino-Laotian border by Pao Nyeri, who you mentioned earlier, Jen. And then Martin, since you have a chapter in this book, on the China-Nepal border, perhaps you'd like to say something about this section, and specifically about some of the border worlds, how we conceive of these border lands or border worlds as worlds, what kind of symmetries and asymmetries are evident there, how you see it from the point of view of your own work there on the China-Nepal border.
Yeah, well, first, I mean, it is important to note that the research that went into this book clearly predates much of what is going on now. I mean, this is a pre Belt and Road Initiative book, ethnographically. Even if it came out in 2017, the workshop we held was 2012. So it was still a few years before Xi Jinping announced the Belt and Road Initiative in Kazakhstan in 2014. So in many ways, these were times where kind of China was very clearly opening its borders and looking to sort of foster trade and foster relations after a phase of closure that clearly had shaped lives along the borders between maybe the 1960s and the early 2000s. So it was this window of opportunity where you had lots and lots of things going on in terms of trade, in terms of small-scale trade, in terms of investment projects, in terms of embedding this neighboring situation in the daily lives of people on both sides of the borders. In the meantime, much of this has actually changed. And sometimes I think that you mentioned James Scott's book before, the Art of Not Being Governed and the idea of Zomia. I mean, his book very clearly refers to a phase in history pre-World War II. And then he basically says that after World War II, through the forces of time-space compression and infrastructure and telecommunication, that that this refuge that afforded anarchist ways of living in the mountains of Southeast Asia actually vanished. And sometimes I think that only now with the Belt and Road Initiative and this huge investment that goes into the construction of new roads and railways, that actually happens. So in at that time, around like 2010, 11, 12, when most of the work research-wise that then went into this book was actually carried out, this was not yet the case.
So roads, I mean, the One Belt, One Road, it's in the name, the roads, but roads are a clear motif and a central point of your own chapter in here. And I suppose, notwithstanding the radical changes and the infrastructural developments that have really accelerated since, actually a certain amount of infrastructural development is key background to your own ethnography, albeit a few years ago. What kind of processes were being sort of generated, reawoken by road construction in the Sino-Nepal Nepalese borderlands at the time when you were doing your research?
It was a time where China built a lot of roads on the Tibetan Plateau, and suddenly many of the valleys of northern Nepal found themselves in this particular situation. Namely, they had suddenly road access to the north, to the Tibetan Plateau, while still having no roads that would connect them to the urban centers of Nepal. That triggered a radical reorientation towards the north, towards Tibet. In these years, and you saw like the emergence of this old Himalayan institution of the seasonal trade mart of the entrepot popping up in several places. It was a very dynamic time, and there was this veritable quest to extend the roads that reached the border from the north down into the valleys of Nepal in order to make better use of this new access to goods and business opportunities. In the meantime, that has changed. This has been going on, and there are even more roads, and roads have been extended, and many of the roads I talk about, they are now complete and they are used. But it also attracted a huge amount of scrutiny by the state on both sides. And that niche that existed in like 2011, 12, 13, 14, 15, where you had lots and lots of business opportunities for the small trader, yeah, for the classical broker, a role that many Himalayan populations have a long history of. That role suddenly became more difficult because of new border regimes, because of more scrutiny by the state.
Interesting. Yeah, I think this is in a sense just an illustration of this constantly dynamic situation there in the borders, and also how sensitive these borderlands locations are to shifts in national policy or in regional kind of priorities and economic developments and so on. And I think all of that emerges when we're looking at a situation like Nepal and the Tibetan border there, which you highlight actually shows some signs of almost oscillating between periods when trade and borderlands border crossing was particularly vigorous, and then more a period of closure, and then potentially a period of renewed opening, as you document there. But perhaps I'll move now onto section two, where I suppose actually some of these questions of grand scale state-state interaction kind of grand initiatives and things come more into play to an extent, because this section is concerned with neighbouring beyond proximity, as it's called, and we zoom out to a certain extent, or at the very least deal with neighbouring situations which are not intimately immediately across border lines on the ground, perhaps. There are chapters in this section by Henrik Alf on Xinjiang, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, cross-border relations there. Chapter by Uradin Bulag on Mongolia and its relationship with neighbours, both Russia, China, and beyond. And finally, a chapter by Tina Harris, also on the Himalayan borderlands, another location there. Jen, it seems to me in this section, as I say, there's a certain zooming out here, which I think makes this concept of neighbouring, in a sense, theoretically richer, because we're not dealing necessarily with situations of immediate confrontation. Perhaps you could say something a little more about how this kind of elevating the perspective aids us in understanding what's going on around China's borders and in neighboring practices with China involved.
Yeah, sure. Just returning to a point that Martin made earlier, that the neighbor is who is neighboring. So I think in this case, we're trying to say that the neighbor who is, you know, someone who wants to be a neighbor. So in that sense, physical distance does not matter if someone really wants to become a neighbor, for example, to China or to perhaps a Southeast Asian country, if there's strategic, I guess, collaborations can be built or opportunities can be found together towards a common goal. So that's sort of our starting point to think about proximity is really important. But in this very dynamic relationship we call neighboring, proximity, it doesn't mean, you know, in a physical sense, doesn't necessarily mean distance. Relationship can still happen regardless if you are staying physically together. So in this sense, certain ethnic groups or, you know, people, traders who are very used to being mobile and travel long distances are very keen at finding pockets of connections, finding that common ties that they can claim some sense of closeness to perhaps a particular group in China or a particular kind of community or, you know, politics that are happening in China. So that certain strategic relationships can be built or connections can be reclaimed, then they can perhaps achieve, I guess, better economic outcomes for their activities or perhaps find new destinations along their trade routes or along their sort of strategic planning for, I guess, international politics in the case of Bullock's chapter. I think that chapter strikes me as really interesting because he really talks about Mongolia's politics, claiming, I guess, the US and Japan as its neighbors, even though it's not even, I guess, physically connected to these countries, whereas Russia and China, as its immediate neighbors, had to balance this external politics between other countries that are putting influence in the region. That shows sort of the kind of neighboring politics that are just beyond physical boundaries, but also in terms of the very symbolic negotiations between states and also between, I guess, individuals who are involved in these kinds of politics. So that's my thinking about, you know, the politics of proximity and how neighboring can take advantage of very close proximity at the same time, claim some sort of fictive kinship or fictive friendship across longer time and distance, just so that some kind of new connections can be made.
Right, right. No, absolutely. I think actually, funnily enough, I remember hearing Bullock say at one point that it's China's attempts almost too vigorously to neighbor with Mongolia, really to try and be too good friends that right. That puts Mongolia off sometimes and makes it go on looking for alternative partners. Martin, do you have anything to add on the benefits of this kind of more elevated perspective? And you brought up the Belt and Road thing. Clearly, Central Asia, Mongolia, these are regions that are very clearly affected by these new policies. Do you have anything to add on in this regard?
Yes. I mean, in both chapters with Hendrik Alf and Uradin Bulak, there is a kind of neighboring going on that is based on proximity. I mean, Hendrik Alf traces that story of bazaar trade in Dardoy Bazaar in Bishkek, which used to be one of the biggest bazaars in Central Asia. And you have this neighboring relation between Kyrgyzstan and China, actually, like transposed into that context of that little bazaar where you have a lot of proximity. So it finds a space in which this proximity is recreated, even if the places that even if the places are far away from each other. And in Nuradin Bulak's case, it's very interesting. He has this funny story of the gift horse. Yeah, I mean, that's how Mongolian diplomacy works. You give a foreign dignitary a gift horse, which is supposed to stay in Mongolia and thrive on the green pastures of Mongolia. So you create sort of that spatially fixed neighboring sort of relationship through this gift horse thing, and then there's a lot of misunderstandings. I mean, Bush gets it, funny enough, and he doesn't take the horse back home. He comes and checks on it, but then Hu Jintao actually didn't get it, and he took the horse back home, and that wasn't really liked by the Mongolians. It wasn't meant to be. So there is an element of geographical proximity transposed into a different context that still is at work, even if we're zooming out, and even if we don't have a situation of a border and two groups on each side.
Yeah, I think, in that sense, that makes this notion of neighboring quite useful to thinking beyond anthropology too, into the world of politics and international relations and the like. That's great. And I think certainly for all his other catastrophic errors, Bush was probably wise not to take the horse home with him. It's a bit of an inconvenient gift.
Maybe he had very good advisors. Yeah.
Yeah, I would think so. I would be surprised if his Mongolian cultural sensitivity was particularly high. But moving on to more sort of perhaps contentious waters here in section three, which is entitled Agonistic Intensities, and really after, I suppose, a moment of respite at a higher level of elevation in section two, we've zoomed back in again on some very local situations. There are four chapters in this final section of the book on Trans-Himalayan and Tibetan borderlands by Chris Vasakumar, on the Burma-Yunnan borderlands by Renaud Igoto, and Jen, your chapter on Sino-Vietnamese border, and then finally a more complementary chapter from Magnus Fischgesior on China's animal neighbors, beyond human look at this notion of neighboring. Jen, since you have your chapter in this section, perhaps you'd like to say something about the kind of slightly more tense relations, or the tensions, productive tensions potentially, but also, of course, also potentially damaging tensions which emerge in these borderlands, and what this notion of agonistic intensities, which actually appeared initially in the introduction, means, and what it does for you here in discussing your Sino-Vietnamese case and other cases.
Yeah, right. So I think this agonistic intensities basically describe the kind of very, paradoxical relations between neighbors. On one hand, you try to at least maintain some sort of surface level friendliness or intimacy so that everyday functions or, collaborations can resume as normal. On the other hand, we can really see deeper levels of distrust, perhaps some historical continuation of certain suspicion and certain, maybe this can be called jealousy, or this can be called various forms of distrust or conflict that at the border that has to be maintained, but at the same time, it cannot be so serious to challenge the kind of peaceful talks, the kind of friendly gestures and all of that. So we just want to find a concept to capture this kind of ambivalent state of emotions and state of, relationship making at the actual borderland. So in these chapters, we're looking at sort of the daily struggles and then the kind of daily negotiation strategies that many of these people who live directly off the border sort of communities, how they experience this and how they basically do various kinds of things. But at the same time, their thinking process can be quite different from what they do. And a lot of the contradictions and a lot of the ironies that happen, because this is all done under the very large umbrella of, you know, friendly neighborliness that China has to build its relation with its neighbors towards, economic prosperity and development and so on and so forth. But at the local level, you see more of the everyday conflicts, more of these discontent and and struggles that are not necessarily serious, but damaging enough to cause discomfort at the local level. So we want to see, you know, how that kind of experience changed the ways in which people understand what it means to be living so close to China. And also, I think another important thing to note when we're thinking about this is what kind of China they're experiencing. Because this is not the China that many would read about in the news reports, in media headlines, about this very powerful, very affluent sort of monstrous nation that are just right there. They are dealing with very concrete, you know, just small traders like themselves. They're dealing with, I guess, peasants, migrants, officials who may be corrupt, sometimes who may be powerless as themselves. So these are the little pieces of China that they experience on a daily basis that can be very different from a lot of the larger pictures of what China is like. For us, this can be a very interesting sort of angle to think about this everyday relationship making. Just the final words about,
Yeah, well, I was just going to ask about some specific cases of these dynamics that you're describing kind of in your ethnography there of the Sino-Vietnamese border trade, and what kind of, situations brought you to these ideas and allowed you to see these ambivalences or these sort of paradoxes really of borderland life. What was the situation you were describing there on the China-Vietnam border?
Yeah, right. So very briefly, so from what I, when I did my research at that time, that was sort of before a very open conflict about South China Sea, about this sort of oil platform kind of controversies that are happening in recent years. There was very little, there was a lot of dispute about South China Sea sovereignty issues and so on and so forth. But at that particular borderland, everybody sort of avoided these kind of political talks and just focused on doing business and make their, basically make money and expand into bigger market shares in whatever trade that they're doing. So there's real focus on very contemporary, very sort of money-driven, I guess, intentions behind their everyday interactions. So trade fair, that's the main focus of that chapter, is, you know, a local initiative, I guess, a government initiative that helped to facilitate a lot of these, trade activities happening at the border. It's a flagship event. But when it happened, then the Chinese traders realized that if, say, some small procedures change and some little things like tariff of certain goods were changed overnight without notification, and then they are powerless to actually exercise that symbolic might that China may have. So in that sense, they come to the border as Chinese traders who bring money and who bring a lot of the commodities that the Vietnamese need. But if local conflict takes place or some sort of agreement has not been reached, they cannot, you know, just exercise that symbolic power that China has. For them, they are just powerless individuals, traders who cannot really do much to improve their situations. So so what they can do basically is just to make small arrangements to do damage control and to really try to make less official kind of negotiations with their Vietnamese counterparts. And for the Vietnamese traders, it's the same. There is some sort of disconnect between the official rhetorics and between the local government's activities or plans and also what the traders really need and what they really want. So all of these things happen at the same time to generate various kinds of conflicts, priorities, and I guess, struggles, I don't know, but in that sense, well, eventually, some business can continue if they just, you know, do it in various kinds of circuitous ways. Otherwise, you will have to go back to, you know, go back to China or go back to Vietnam when such relationships continue. Yeah.
Yeah, and you mentioned some quite actually surprising instances there of Chinese truckers and traders protesting against unforeseen shifts in regulations and things. It's not a story you hear a great deal about.
Yeah, no.
The sort of
Yeah, so this kind of things then all get silenced because you never hear about conflicts in media reports about trade fair success. That's not really the kind of headline that you want to, you know, generate. You still want people to think that trade goes on as usual. People are making money. They're living happily ever after as neighbors. But these kind of, you know, concrete conflicts that can really change people's lives, they lose money, then they, you know, feel very unhappy about, but it doesn't really matter under the sort of the larger discourse about China's peaceful, you know, relationship with its neighbors. So that just captures an episode, yeah, and that happened.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, it's, and it's very valuable. That's the value, really, that this very localized borderland perspective brings to it, because, as you say, on the macro level and in the certain official media reports, actually, not only in China, you hear about everything being rosy, and they're quite learn so much about these localized antagonisms or antagonistic intensities. Lots of what comes out in that chapter, actually, in the section as a whole, are ideas of in-betweenness, of ambivalence, as you mentioned, Jen, that are present throughout the book. And Martin, if I could just turn back to you as we come towards the end. These ideas of in-betweenness are key in your chapter, and as I mentioned throughout. And I just wonder, kind of looking forward, or actually looking to the contemporary situation, since I know you're still working in this sphere, is the grand strategy, the real push right out to the borders that we might see being a part of the Belt and Road Initiative, is this reducing the extent to which borderlands around China are kind of in-between spaces, ambivalent spaces? Do you see any kind of shift in this condition that maybe draws together a lot of the borderlands that appear in this book?
Martin, yes and no. This really depends on which place you are looking at, I think. I mean, on the one hand, there is almost everything is now Belt and Road. Yeah, whatever development initiative came under a different name is now part of the Belt and Road, program. And they are like along the Myanmar Yunnan border, for example, there are many new border posts built that sort of try to reopen trade routes that were important before, and there this still plays, but on a bigger scale. And other places, like in Tibet and Xinjiang, what you see is that in many places the regardless of all the current trouble, that in many places actually the border posts moved back from the Chinese border 100 kilometers inland, and then you create this new kind of border zone and in limbo, where you have entered Chinese territory but you're not yet stamped in, which is an altogether different kind of in-betweenness created through this shift in the ways in which China is policing its borders. So I wouldn't be able to kind of give you a general answer to it, but to this, but there is a lot going on at the moment. And the asymmetries, they are really striking. I mean, the amount of money and effort invested in border infrastructure and in surveillance infrastructure on the Chinese side has no counterpart in all the countries just around it.
No, that's right. And it would be worth mentioning, of course, at this point, the really grievous and devastating situation in Xinjiang at the moment, with hundreds of thousands of Uyghurs imprisoned or forced into re-education camps, which I would encourage listeners to do some research on, because it's necessary knowledge about contemporary China. Well, to close out, Jen and Martin, thank you so much. We've taken up quite a bit of your time, and I think you've done a great job of giving us a feel for this fascinating book, despite its, as you say, the kind of long process during which it was produced. Before we close out completely, perhaps I could just ask our traditional final question, namely, what is it that each of you is up to at the moment? Jen, perhaps you'd like to go first.
Yeah, sure. So when I was doing my project, basically my PhD project at the border, I started to get in contact with a lot of the Chinese gamblers who, of course, because gambling is illegal in China, they have to cross the border into a lot of the borderland casinos to gamble. So then that started quite an interesting sort of pet project about borderland casinos, and then that led to larger project about Asian casinos that are suddenly mushrooming across various kinds of developing Asian countries, such as Vietnam, Philippines, Cambodia, and of course the casino destinations of Singapore and Macau. So for me, Asian casinos became a new interest to understand how suddenly this transnational capital all flooded into Asia, investing in gambling as an industry, and how that changes the kind of new social dynamics across the nation, with gamblers mainly come from China. So that's my new interest at the moment. Yeah.
Wow. Fantastic. That sounds great. Very exciting.
Japan is the next on the list, right? It's recently passed the bill to open casinos. So let's see what's happening there.
Right. Yeah. Well, there you go. That's a new potential field site for you right there.
Nice.
Martin, how about you? I mentioned the research project you're involved in at the head of the interview. Could you tell us a little more about that and whatever projects you have going on currently?
Yes, after I left Singapore, I extended this interest in neighboring China to Central Asia. So I was doing quite a bit of research in Tajikistan, in the Pamirs, and currently I'm on three different projects. I'm on one thing that I do is I write my second book on this remoteness and connectivity issue. It's called Place Knots, and that is still the Himalaya book that comes out of this decade of research on the Himalayas. But I'm also working on a documentary film on Murgap, which is this place in the Pamirs that used to be the Soviet Union's highest town. A documentary film that will come out in spring, hopefully. And the third project we're working on is an exhibition on stuff from the highlands of Asia. We actually launched a call for stuff 8-9 months ago, rather than a call for papers, where we the title of the exhibition is Highland Flotsam. So what we try to do is we bring things with like material sediments, stuff left behind with cosmopolitan biographies, to Munich, to an art gallery in May, in order to produce a different picture of the ways in which these seemingly remote places in the highlands of Asia have inserted themselves in the world at large. That's the three Brilliant. Things I'm working on at the moment.
Brilliant. Well, it's great to hear from you both that such rich and fertile projects have grown out of the work that went into this book. Jen and Martin, thank you both so much for appearing on the show today. It was absolutely great talking to you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ed.
And listeners, thanks to you for listening, as ever, to the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast, which is a podcast channel on the New Books Network. We will speak to you next time.